Okay, I'm going to pick up in chapter 4 from page 34, down near the bottom of the page, the final paragraph that begins under the shed. Under the shed on one side of the yard, there was constructed a rough table, while overhead were sleeping lofts, the same as the pen in Washington. After partaking at this table of our supper of pork and bread, I was handcuffed to a large yellow man, quite stout and fleshy, with a countenance expressive of the utmost melancholy. He was a man of intelligence and information. Chained together, it was not long before we became acquainted with each other's history. So this is, again, he's in Richmond. He's chained up there at Gooden's slave pen. And he's going to tell us about this sort of friendship that formed with this man he was handcuffed to. And it's notable, Greg has actually highlighted it, because it's notable that they're building this community despite their terrible circumstances. And this is a theme throughout history. You can see things like this also in the Holocaust and the concentration camps. There were sort of like mini communities that formed just out of necessity in spite of the terrible situation that people were in. It's very similar here. So we're going to hear about this man. His name was Robert. Like myself, he had been born free and had a wife and two children in Cincinnati. He said he had come south with two men who had hired him in the city of his residence. Without free papers, he had been seized at Fredericksburg, placed in confinement, and beaten until he had learned, as I had, the necessity and the policy of silence. He had been in Gooden's pen about 3 weeks. To this man, I became much attached. We could sympathize with and understand each other. It was with tears and a heavy heart not many days subsequently that I saw him die and looked for the last time upon his lifeless form. So we're going to hear about that in a little bit. Actually, Robert ends up passing away. But it's just that friendship is notable. They became, he says, much attached. That's pretty notable in this terrible time. It's sort of a method of survival, I would think, sort of psychological survival. Robert and myself, with Clem, Eliza, and her children, slept that night upon our blankets in one of the small houses in the yard. There were four others, all from the same plantation, who had been sold and were now on their way south, who also occupied it with us. So they're sleeping in this little house, and he's going to tell us who's there. David and his wife Caroline, both mulattoes, were exceedingly affected. They dreaded the thought of being put into the cane and cotton fields, but their greatest source of anxiety was the apprehension of being separated. So we're learning again that slaves feared not only becoming slaves, or black people feared not only becoming slaves, but also, you know, like a couple being separated. That's a devastating thought. Where am I? Right. Mary, a tall, lithe girl of a most jetty black, was listless and apparently indifferent. Like many of the class, she scarcely knew there was such a word as freedom. Brought up in the ignorance of a brute, she possessed but little more than a brute's intelligence. She was one of those, and there are very many, who fear nothing but their master's lash, and know no further duty than to obey his voice. This Mary sounds like she grew up a slave. She's living as a slave now. She knows, she doesn't even know freedom as Solomon did and Eliza had a taste of. The other was Letha. I'm not sure I'm saying that right, guys, but I'm just going to go with Letha. The other was Letha. She was of an entirely different character. She had long, straight hair and bore more the appearance of an Indian than a Negro woman. She had sharp and spiteful eyes, and continually gave utterance to the language of hatred and revenge. Her husband had been sold. She knew not where she was. An exchange of masters, she was sure, could not be for the worse. She cared not whither they might carry her. Pointing to the scars upon her face, the desperate creature wished that she might see the day when she could wipe them off in some man's blood. So Letha sounds like pretty angry, but also sort of resigned to her fate that things are just sort of terrible for her right now. While we were thus learning the history of each other's wretchedness, Eliza was seated in a corner by herself, singing hymns and praying for her children. Wearied from the loss of so much sleep, I could no longer bear up against the advances of that sweet restorer, he's talking about sleep, and laying down by the side of Robert on the floor, soon forgot my troubles and slept until the dawn of day. So he's just sort of painting this picture of his first night in Gooden's pen, who was there, and what their circumstances were. In the morning, having swept the yard and washed ourselves under Gooden's superintendence, we were ordered to roll up our blankets and make ready for the continuance of our journey. Clem Ray was informed that he would go no further, Birch, for some cause, having concluded to carry him back to Washington. Remember, Clem Ray is another slave who Solomon met in Washington, and now apparently he has learned he's going back to Washington. He was much rejoiced. Shaking hands, we parted in the slave pen at Richmond, and I have not seen him since. But, much to my surprise, since my return, I learned that he had escaped from bondage, and on his way to the free soil of Canada, lodged one night at the house of my brother-in-law in Saratoga, informing my family of the place and the condition in which he left me. Talk about a bond formed here. Clem Ray breaks out from slavery. He escapes, and he starts to head north to Canada, where they did not have slavery, and he could live as a free man. And on the way, he stays in Saratoga with Solomon Northup's brother-in-law. And he tells them, don't worry, I saw him, he was okay. And, I mean, it must be just such a relief. You can imagine, his family hasn't had any word about him until this time. That's pretty impressive. In the afternoon, we were drawn up, two abreast, that means two side by side, Robert and myself in advance, and in this order, driven by Birch and Gooden from the yard, through the streets of Richmond to the brig Orleans. She was a vessel of respectable size, fully rigged, and freighted principally with tobacco. He's talking about the ship. He says it's a regular size ship, and it's carrying mostly tobacco. We were all on board by 5 o'clock. Birch brought us each a tin cup and a spoon. There were 40 of us in the brig, being all except Clem that were in the pen. With a small pocket knife that had not been taken from me, I began cutting the initials of my name upon the tin cup. The others immediately flocked around me, requesting me to mark theirs in a similar manner. In time I gratified them all, of which they did not appear to be forgetful. So he uses his pocket knife to, like, carve his initials in his cup, and then everybody wants to do it. You can imagine, everything has been taken from them. So even like having their own cup must have felt like some kind of ownership, which is really sad and kind of pathetic. I mean, but not that they are pathetic, but the situation is so terrible. We were all stowed away in the hold at night and the hatch barred down. We laid on boxes or wherever there was room enough to stretch our blankets on the floor. Birch accompanied us no further than Richmond, returning from that point to the capital with Clem. Not until the lapse of almost 12 years, to wit, in January last, in the Washington police office, did I set my eyes upon his face again. So Solomon's telling us, from this moment he hadn't seen Birch again until he saw him in the police station in Washington. And he's going to give us sort of a final word on Birch. James H. Birch was a slave trader, buying men, women, and children at low prices and selling them at an advance. He was a speculator in human flesh, a disreputable calling, and so considered at the South. For the present, he disappears from the scenes recorded in this narrative, but he will appear again before its close, not in the character of a man-whipping tyrant. So he says, all right, he's going to be done from the story, but he's going to come back. He's not going to come back as like this tyrant, this vicious man whipping us, but as an arrested, cringing criminal in a court of law that failed to do him justice. So we're going to see him again, but when we do, he'll be in the court. I'm assuming Solomon must have sued him. That's it for chapter 4.